question.
Sure. Okay. Yeah, two pairs and then one individual tonsil for the adenoids.
Okay. So which ones are necessary and which ones aren't? Like, are they technically necessary?
They're technically, they didn't used to think they were necessary, but now they think they're more involved in lymphocytes, which help program antibodies, and then macrophages. So they'll take them out, though, if they block the air path flowing through.
Which is more important.
Yeah, which is more important. They've got to weigh those, yeah.
Okay.
Breathing.
Breathing.
I didn't realize it's that they tend to really atrophy as you get older, so they tend to do less work for us as we get older.
I read something about that, like they're more predominant in your child.
Yeah.
Because I hear a lot of, like when I was younger, a lot of kids got their tonsils taken out.
Yeah.
Like it was just the thing. And then it's not the thing, but you know.
You have an infection, you get your tonsils out. Yeah,
right.
That's, I think, less so nowadays unless they're, like, you know, rubbing or blocking those air pathways.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. All right, so on the top of page 71, we're going to talk about some respiratory disorders. The top three are actually disorders of the pleura affecting those linings covering the outside of the lungs. The others listed down below are technically what we consider to be obstructive, and I did list for you there two restrictive disorders, so we'll get to those in just a moment. First off, can you tell me what the pleura do? Where are they found?
Lungs.
Good. Outside or inside?
Outside.
Outside, good. And how are they constructed? How are the pleura constructed? Good. Pair, there's a visceral and a parietal. And between the two layers?
Serous
fluid. Good. And the function of that fluid?
Reduce friction.
Good. So keeping that in mind, let's talk first about pleurisy. Okay, there we go. So let's talk first about pleurisy. That's fast forwarding, but that's not fast forwarding. I do have it loaded. Would you like to start with that?
Yes.
Okay. Let me get out of that.
Well, did you know that it takes 100 muscles just to say the word hello? That was exhausting. Or that it takes 120 million photoreceptors just for our eyes to see? Well, the human body really is an incredible machine, and with a little help from an unlikely...
Let's see if it'll let me do it this way. Let's try it one more time, see if it'll work this time. This is crazy, because I can get it to play on here, but you guys can't see it. Oh, we're doing better than we were the other day.
You just turn around the thing.
I could do that. I'm getting ready to do that, because this is nuts.
That it takes 100 muscles just to say the word hello? That was exhausting. Or that it takes 120 million
Oh, no!
Can we pull that up?
You can pull that up, yeah. If you go to YouTube and pull up Steven Tyler vocal cords, I'm pretty sure it'll come up with this. It's the human machine, or incredible human machine. Let's see if it'll play. Now it's going to misbehave.
It's really cool because they do shine that laryngoscope down his throat.
Well, did you know that it takes 100 muscles just to say the word hello? That was exhausting. Or that it takes 120 million photoreceptors just for our eyes to see? Well, the human body really is an incredible machine. And with a little help from an unlikely rock star, Steven Tyler of Aerosmith, the National Geographic Channel is about to show us just how amazing it is. Aerosmith's Steven Tyler, whose raspy voice was all but ruined by years of singing and, he says, heroin use, awoke one day to learn his vocal cords were
bleeding. That would do it.
Enter Harvard Med School's Dr. Steven Zeitels, who operated on Tyler and then monitored his vocal cords as he performed live in front of thousands to try to figure out how this all works and show us. We've got the tape and the doctor. Dr. Zeitels, thanks so much for being here. He's the director of voice rehabilitation at Harvard Med School. So, this is fascinating. Steven Tyler comes to you saying, my vocal cords are bleeding, that's not good. You perform this operation to try to get them back into shape, and then what did you do at this rock concert?
Well, we basically were documenting whether we really had stable vocal cords. We actually endoscoped them. We also wired them up with some new scientific equipment, which we could determine the number of even collisions that he had, and that actually was quite remarkable. So we had real-time measures, which the National Geographic helped us put in play and document. It was 780,000 collisions in one concert.
Is this him backstage while
That's
he's giving
correct.
The concert?
That's correct. What we wanted to do, and this was a advancement over a pilot sort of initial study that Stephen and I did in Colorado a number of years ago. We're really trying to understand what happens in the midst of a high performance concert.
So how does that help you? So you say that the vocal cords flap together over 500,000 times. Why do we care?
Well, because people's vocal cords wear out. We have an aging society in which the pharmaceutical companies are doing a great job at keeping people alive longer, and yet their vocal cords are simply getting traumatized. And we're developing strategies at the Mass General, MIT, and Harvard to really reconstitute tissues. When you use a high-performance singer, it's like an athlete so that you can understand even what normal voice use is.
And after he had this surgery, this is kind of gross to look at, but also kind of cool. I'm sure it's old hat for you. But after you did the surgery and you did this whole thing for National Geographic, how is he? Are his vocal cords back to normal now?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you have to understand, Steven is an amazing performer. The changes that naturally occurred from years and decades of singing, and put in perspective, there's probably no one who's sung as many large-scale rock shows with the frequency. Those changes have occurred, and he uses those as a performance strategy.
Yeah.
So he can do things today he couldn't do 20 years ago, and vice versa.
And I also should mention, since we said in the intro that he now says that he is drug-free. Anyway, I got to leave it at that because we're out of time, but Dr. Zeitels, thanks so much for being here. And there's the program, Incredible Human Machine, Sunday, October 21st, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Very cool stuff.
Okay, so let's get...
all these years, but they're
Let's
still
get
alive
his up so you can
do
see
it.
That.
Now well into their 60s, singer Steven Tyler and lead guitarist...
We'll just listen to Aerosmith all class. How about What's that? I'm assuming it probably caused like the degradation of the vocal cords.
Okay.
Let's see. Okay, so this is the actual video.
The trauma we generate in our voice boxes when we talk, sing, laugh, or scream. But take a look down the talented gullet of Steven Tyler, Aerosmith's lead singer. And you get a feel for why he and millions of others are wreaking havoc on a delicate instrument.
Okay.
Tonight, as Aerosmith performs, Dr. Steven Zeitels and his team from Massachusetts General Hospital will get a rare treat. With the help of special monitoring equipment, they'll see how this famous pair of vocal cords holds up to such extremes.
Dr. Zeitels, one time for my kids, what is this monitoring?
What we're going to be doing is looking at the vibrations on the skin of your neck, which is going to pick up the intensity of your voice. Mm-hmm. It's going to be picking up the loudness of your voice. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, doctor.
Okay.
Into the abyss.
Into the great beyond.
There we go.
With Dr. Zeitel.
Backstage, throughout tonight's concert, Zeitels will use an endoscope to examine Tyler's voice box up close.
See, can I have the gauze?
Try not to touch the sides.
Yep. It's a rare insight into what goes on in a high-performance singer.
Real-time measures of a performer who is at the top of his game, doing a live performance in front of thousands of people. That's a first. It hasn't been done before.
To produce these kinds of sounds, Tyler's vocal cords are slamming together an average of 170 times a second. That's more than 500,000 times during the course of a concert. And nearly 1 billion times during the course of his 30-year professional career.
There's no part of the human body that likely sees these kinds of collision forces and shearing stresses, which is why vocal folds essentially wear out over time.
It's also why just months earlier, damaged vocal cords canceled much of Aerosmith's tour.
Yeah, you got to see his throat, right? Okay. Oh, there's more.
Forcing him to undergo Zeitel's knife. Or...
I think it's pretty cool to see those vocal cords.
Steven recently a vocal bleed, which is very common in performance.
Okay, so that actually is a 10-minute video. If you want to see the National Geographic part, just look up Steven Tyler, and it's called The Incredible Human Machine on YouTube, and that I think is probably the one of the only ones that comes up. So pretty interesting stuff there. This thing gets in its head that it wants to do a presentation, and it's going to do it. All right, let's see if it'll do my other one. Yeah, now we're good. Okay. All right, so let's talk about some respiratory problems. The first one we want to talk about is called pleurisy. And this particular disorder is the result of inflammation around the outside of the lungs. Anybody ever had pleurisy? It's a good thing. It's a painful condition. I just want to make the point here that inflammation does not necessarily mean infection. The inflammation that occurs just means that those linings are irritated and swollen. So, you know, normally we were talking about those pleura should glide and slide past each other, but if those two pleura become swollen, what happens to their glide and slide? Rubbing. Yeah, a lot of friction there. So if somebody does have pleurisy, every time they take a breath in or out or both, they may experience a stabbing pain or a dull aching pain in one part of their lungs. So oftentimes what happens is, you know, people get pneumonia, they get treatment, they may have a round of antibiotics that don't work, they go back and get another round of antibiotics, and their lungs just say, you know, we're tired of this. And of course, the inflammation results, in that pleurisy pain. So that is unfortunate. We have to get rid of the root cause in order to get rid of the pleurisy. So you typically have to treat the actual disease, treat the pneumonia, and then the pleurisy will follow suit and go away. If a person's really uncomfortable, they can prescribe a medication that reduces inflammation. Steroid, good. So what is the problem with taking a long-term steroid? It does break down the bones, and it gives you a disease called?
Cushing's.
Good, gives you Cushing's. So there's, you know, certainly the pros and cons of taking something like that.
So the inflammation is causing the pleural and the visceral layers to rub together, which is causing the pain?
That's right.
Okay.
Other things that can cause pleurisy are smoking. So, you know, stopping smoking would be the way to get rid of the pleurisy. You know, there's maybe a heart infection that has irritated the lining of the lungs. That, too, can cause pleurisy. Let's see. Our next pleural issue is called a pneumothorax. This is technically air space in between the visceral and parietal pleura. You know, bacteria sometimes can produce gas. And if there's an infection here, that can produce this, basically an air bubble between the two parietal and visceral layers. Sometimes, you know, a broken rib can impact and inject into that area. That can introduce air. Even a stab wound can also inject air into those two areas. The problem with having air between the visceral and parietal pleura is it can produce a collapsed lung. And the fancy name for a collapsed lung is atelectasis. What a name, atelectasis. I think these lungs look like mandarin oranges. I'm hungry, so I'll eat them. Okay, so obviously that is not air, right? Collapsed lung, yes. So that lung has been reduced from this size to a little less than a half. Yeah. That's kind of a cool picture. You can actually see a tube there that's standing open. I wonder what that is. Trachea. That is trachea, yeah. Because if it was the esophagus, it would not be standing open. Let's see, this is pleural effusion. It's kind of causing the same issues that a pneumothorax would cause. This condition, however, is some kind of fluid around the lungs, maybe extra serous fluid. It could be pus from an infection. Even blood, you know, can accumulate between those two layers, or even lymph can accumulate between those two layers. So again, we need to draw out this fluid, and we do so with a chest tube. It's a large needle inserted into those two layers, and it allows for the fluid to drain. It does look painful. So the goal is to remove the fluid, allow the lung to reinflate, because the lung is not going to inflate as long as there's something pushing on it, causing a pressure change in that visceral and parietal space.
What causes the fluid?
It could be a number of things. It could be an infection. Cancers can lead to, say, pus or blood in that area. It could be excess fluid from, you know, irritation. So a number of things. Whatever the cause, it's just fluid.
Okay.
All right, so there's a pretty sizable pleural effusion accumulating there. Again, the black space is air. That should be where the lungs are located. Let's talk about the other kinds of pulmonary diseases. They are classified as obstructive or restrictive. You probably have heard that obstructive, O for out, is an easy way to keep that straight. So the obstructive disorders are the ones that we're going to go into detail with. The restrictive disorders are ones that cause problems with airflow in. So we're not going to really discuss in any detail, though, pulmonary fibrosis, which comes with scar tissue of the lungs. They're less flexible, less elastic. And obesity can also lead to restrictive airflow. That means, again, the person is having difficulty getting the air into the lungs. Interesting to note that both types, both obstructive and restrictive disorders, can lead to shortness of breath. So let me talk you through some of those obstructive disorders. The issue with these is there's some impediment to getting the airflow out of the lungs. But as we know, if you're having trouble breathing out, it's going to also cause you to have trouble breathing in. So in fact, some of these obstructive disorders may also experience restrictive issues. Just checking to see if anybody still needs a slide. Good. So our first obstructive issue is called emphysema, and smoking is the number one cause of emphysema.
So you'll notice the way this guy is sitting. It's a particular position that makes it easier for him to breathe. They think that sitting in this position helps the natural mechanics of the way that your chest cavity works and allows for the natural expiration of air. Normally, to expire air out of your lungs is a passive process. What does it mean to be passive? No energy, right? No ATP, no energy. So normally, to exhale air, you don't have to work for it. But in the case of emphysema, patients have to actively work using ATP to force the air out of their lungs. So sitting like this helps this man force the air out. Also, notice his chest cavity here. Notice this man here have a very thin, narrow chest wall. They don't have a large chest cavity. That's because they're actively working to force the air out of their lungs. Also, take a look at his mouth. It looks like he's pursed up to smoke a cigarette, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That is called the pink puffer effect from emphysema. He's not smoking a cigarette there, but what he's trying to do is purse his lips and puff out the air. So you can see it really clearly there. It's a way to help move the air out of the lungs. This guy can't really see. He's not really doing that with his mouth. So pink puffers are emphysema patients, and they're doing that because of the damage done to their alveolar air sacs. Let me show you what's happening there. Normal alveoli should look like grape clusters. They should have elasticity to be able to recoil back after you exhale out a breath of air. But when emphysema takes effect, we notice that those air sacs have lost their shape, and they look like a bunch of grapes that have been squashed. Excuse me. So unfortunately, the loss of the shape of the alveolar air sac means you don't have the natural recoil and resiliency to get the air out of the lungs. So that change on that level leads to them, you know, patients having to force the air out during expiration. So this is a great example of how emphysema is an obstructive disorder. Is the difficulty getting the air in or out? Getting it out, right. And it's all due to this loss of elastic function of the lungs, the loss of that resiliency that helps the air normally be pushed out. Okay, so smoking can be, you know, a huge contributor to the process of emphysema formation in the lungs. There is smoker's lung on the right. Smoking also affects more than just our lungs. It can affect your digestive system and the way it functions. It can also affect your integumentary system and the way you age. Can you tell which one of these is the smoker?
The right.
On the right, yeah. And another pair of twins. Again, the right-handed one. Yeah, that one's the smoker over there. So other things can also lead to emphysema besides smoking. Working in a construction environment where there's a lot of dust and debris can also introduce particulate matter into the lungs. That can cause emphysema. Likewise, working as a welder, which is a really good paying job, can also lead to emphysema. So what you're seeing in this picture, these dark metal parts, these are all metal shards that have been inhaled into the lungs. Yeah. And unfortunately, once it's in there, you can't get rid of it, so it's a permanent fixture in your lungs. So in addition to wearing a welder's helmet, they probably should wear some kind of breathing equipment too.
How about painters? Like, how about painters? What would you think about that?
I imagine if they're getting the air, if they're using a spray, you know, I imagine that gets into the lungs. I'm sure that does something over a lifetime.
Yeah.
That and people who work around dust, I can imagine that cause, you know, whether you're cleaning or construction, that has got to get in there and cause problems.
Denture lab technicians as well.
That's an interesting point. Yeah, because they're grinding stuff.
What did she say?
Denture lab technicians. Yeah, you just don't realize how many people. Yeah. So, you know, think about 10, 20 years of working in that job and breathing in that stuff. That's going to cause some damage. Well, see, another type of obstructive disorder is called asthma. Now, we probably all heard of this one. What are some things that trigger an asthma attack?
Dust.
Smoke.
Allergens.
Allergens,
pollen.
Smell.
Secondhand smoke, yeah.
Exercise.
Exercise.
Yeah, exercise. My dog has exercise and food stamps.
That's no fun.
Fur.
Yeah.
Fur,
yeah.
She's an athlete.
Is she carrying an inhaler? Or?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The cold, too.
Cold, yeah. Yeah, I think temperature changes, you're right, induce asthma.
Now, my son has asthma, and when he lived here, it was bad. And when we lived in Japan, it was kind of bad, but now he lives in a cold climate, and it's better.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So there must be something like the allergens here.
The allergens
or less humidity. Like,
yeah, less humidity.
Yeah, he hasn't been sick since he's gotten
ready. Interesting. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's more of a not a yo-yo temperature like we've got here,
yeah,
too, that helps.
Cold.
Yeah. That's true. So you can see that during an asthma attack, the bronchial passageways can become inflamed. They can accumulate mucus, and that does make it difficult to get the air out of the lungs. And of course, if you're having trouble breathing out, it kind of puts you in panic mode that you can't breathe in either. So oftentimes, it's not just breathing out that becomes the issue, it's also getting the air from coming in. Thinking back to hormones, what is a hormone that will help reduce inflammation here?
Cortisol.
Good. So cortisone can reduce inflammation. And another thing we think about in terms of hormones or neurotransmitters can actually dilate these bronchial passageways.
ACH?
The opposite of ACH is?
Epinephrine.
So epinephrine and norepinephrine can dilate these respiratory passageways. So, of course, we want to be cautious about using either cortisol or epinephrine. Long-term cortisol use leads to Cushing's, like we were just talking. What could epinephrine do to, say, your heart?
Tachycardia,
right. So, you know, we would want to look at how we work with those. Thankfully, there's different kinds of beta receptors on your lungs as from your heart. So if they use, you know, epinephrine for, say, bronchial passageways, then they may not actually cause your heart rate to increase. And that would be the goal. We don't necessarily want to give you tachycardia for an asthma attack. All right, so there's asthma. Let's talk about another third and final obstructive disorder. This one is called bronchitis, and they're often referred to as blue bloater patients. That is in contrast to the pink puffer that we associate with the emphysema patient. So this doesn't sound like a very good outcome, does it? Once again, smoking can be a leading cause of chronic bronchitis. And when we say chronic, what do we mean?
Reoccurring.
Is it going away?
No.
It's not, right? So it's not an acute case. It's a chronic case that tends to stick around. Again, the issue here may be an inflamed bronchial passageway. It can reduce the airflow out, which then in turn reduces the airflow in. And that's where we get the blue bloater problem from, because of the bronchial passageway inflammation. So we end up seeing things like hypoxia and cyanosis. What does cyanosis typically indicate?
Decreased
oxygenation. So let's take this full circle to understand the last issue here, which is heart failure. If you have low oxygen in your aorta and common carotid arteries, what kind of receptor picks up on that?
Chemoreceptors.
And they tattletale to your medulla. Good. And that control center up there says to do what?
Beat faster,
you're right. And vessels should constrict. So your heart rate goes up, your blood pressure goes up, just to circulate the less oxygen that you have in the first place.
Would that also cause like your bone marrow to release more red blood cells also?
It could, which makes your blood thicker.
Yeah,
and it makes
along with the constriction of the vessels.
Yeah. So you've kind of got a double whammy there happening in that setup. So you notice this guy's barrel chest compared to the other. The emphysema patient had a very narrow chest wall. So this comes from ascites, which comes from heart failure, the fluid accumulation around the belly area, and the heart failing as a pump. So long term, you know, we see the perfect storm of diseases coming together. Emphysema, asthma, and chronic bronchitis lead to COPD, and that is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or disorder. So yeah, it is a chronic issue. It will not get better. Sometimes with COPD, we see the same issues. We see those alveoli lose their functional efficiency. That means that they are like squished grapes. They rupture and they are no longer able to exhale the air in the same condition, you know, like we see with emphysema. And I wanted to show you these pictures. You can really get a sense of the loss of surface area in the COPD up here on the left. And this one here actually shows some of those alveolar air sacs. They look like, you know, damaged grapes. Okay. So that should do it for page 71. How about questions there on respiratory disorders?
Like bronchitis and asthma?
Asthma, yes. Bronchitis, I'm thinking, is probably more likely a environmental thing like smoking. But asthma, yeah.
So my mother-in-law has it, and she has all three of us. She was diagnosed like 2 years ago with COPD, and she had asthma. And then, of course, she had bronchitis, asthma. I said, well, what's bronchitis? And then now it says she has COPD.
Wow. That is a lot. Yeah, that's. Does she have like a breathing issue? Gotcha. Goodness, that is. I mean, that's a lot of stuff going on to manage.
Yeah, she used to be a smoker too.
Then there's that other component.
So that's where the bronchitis come from.
Most smoking? They say most likely that's where the chronic bronchitis comes from is smoking. Mm-hmm. Same thing with emphysema. Yeah.
Ms. Taylor.
Yeah.
My grandmother ended up with COPD. She never smoked, but she used to chew.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it must have been enough to irritate that.
Absolutely.
Wow. Yeah, you just don't think about, you know, people don't think about that kind of stuff. Wow. So they should go to elementary schools and tell, scare kids, right?
Yeah.
Don't smoke. Show them these nasty, gnarly pictures.
They have those commercials.
They do have some pretty good commercials nowadays.
Yeah. You see the one with the lung and skiing? That's a little...
I don't think I've seen it. I'll have to Google
that. Lung commercial?
You guys see the one with this tear.
Yeah.
We would pull it up and look, but my computer disagrees with me. Okay, so let me take you on over to page 72. About halfway down the page, we did on Tuesday those tracings at the top. Let me ask if there's any questions on those tracings.
Yeah, what did you say about the bottom part? You said something that was...
The CO2 pathway out will probably be a multiple choice question here or there. I may say to you that we are CO2 in the tertiary bronchus. Where do we go next?
Secondary
bronchus, right. So you'll just want to appreciate that it's the backwards flow of oxygen.
Okay.
I'll pass this down this way for y'all want to keep lights off or you want them back on?
You can leave them off.
Okay. So we've got, I'm about halfway down your page, a little bit of information on the respiratory system's general functions. You know, I know you probably knew many years ago that the function of the respiratory system is to exchange gases. So of course now we're going to figure out how that happens. We already know from our last chapter that the cardiovascular system works to distribute those blood gases out to our cells and tissues. So I put a picture of a mitochondrion on your worksheet to just remind us the reason we breathe is to service those mitochondria with blood gases. So if you think back to learning about cellular respiration, what are the two primary ingredients or reactants needed to make ATP?
Glucose.
And oxygen. Good. So you eat food to get the glucose, and of course the oxygen comes from the respiratory center or the respiratory system. So we bring the oxygen in, we deliver it to our cells and tissues. Our cells have mitochondria that make ATP. And as a waste product, we move CO2 out of our bodies, and we have to remove it, otherwise it can acidify our bloodstream. So The term cellular respiration actually means something when you think about bringing in oxygen from mitochondria and then getting rid of the CO2. And it's no mistake that our respiratory system performs respiration. So just kind of wanted to tie those terms together there. There's four main events to respiration. One is called pulmonary ventilation. It's just fancy wording for breathing. Pulmonary ventilation is just fancy language for breathing. That's going to be one of the first things we talk about today, is how we breathe in and out. All right, so the next major function of your respiratory process is to externally respire. And what that means is to do a gas exchange at your lungs. So our lungs, of course, have those thin-walled alveolar air sacs. They are great for performing a gas exchange. The pulmonary capillaries that surround the alveolar air sac allows for a good deal of oxygen and CO2 to be exchanged simply by diffusion. So let me show you how close in contact those are. Whoops, I got past. You'll notice the bloodstream traveling through here, right next door to your alveolar air sac. Both are made up of simple squamous epithelial tissue, and that means we can simply move oxygen and CO2 by diffusion. On your worksheet, let me draw your attention to two terms there, loading and unloading. Loading implies that we're moving a gas into the bloodstream for transport. What does unloading imply? Moving it out. Good, so loading moves it in.
You said what page? I'm sorry.
That's on the very bottom of page 72, under the four events of respiration. Okay, so loading moves blood gases in to the bloodstream. Unloading moves them out. So in the lungs, when we do a gas exchange here, what blood gas do we aim to move into the bloodstream?
Oxygen.
Good. So we say we load oxygen during external respiration, and at the same time we unload CO2. So carbon dioxide moves from the pulmonary capillaries into the alveolar air sacs. Where is the next step? Where do we go with that CO2 next? So you're in the alveolar air sac with CO2. You're going to move it out of your body. Where do you go next?
Bronchioles,
good. And then a tertiary,
secondary.
Good. And then to the trachea, good. And then, of course, we get that out of the upper respiratory passageways. So the carbon dioxide is exiting while the oxygen is entering into our body. So let me take you next to the step called respiratory gas transport. And let's look at this picture. We know we pick up oxygen in the lungs. We load that oxygen into our pulmonary capillaries. Let's now take it for a ride. Let's go around the body. We go back to the heart by way of pulmonary venules and pulmonary veins, and we end up in which chamber?
Left atrium.
Good. Travel down to the left ventricle, and then the blood is ejected out through the aortic semilunar valve to the aorta. The aorta gives rise to arteries and arterioles, and then capillaries. Let's stop at those capillaries for just a moment. These systemic capillaries perform a second gas exchange. This gas exchange is now called internal respiration. So this is the gas exchange that occurs inside your body between your systemic cells and the surrounding capillaries. All right, so let's look at a different picture. Now, if we're in your pinky finger right now performing gas exchange, oxygen is being transported by the bloodstream. Oxygen moves by diffusion out into your cells and tissues. Is that loading or unloading?
Loading.
Moving it out of the bloodstream?
Unloading.
That's unloading, good. And CO2 being made by your mitochondria needs a ride back to the heart, so it's going to
load.
Yeah, load it back in the bloodstream.
So everything is in respect to the capillary?
Everything's respect to the capillary, that's right. So we just loaded CO2 in the bloodstream here at the capillaries. Let's now take it back to the heart. we join up with venules, we take it to veins, and now where are we?
Right atrium.
Good. We travel through the tricuspid valve.
Right
ventricle. Good. Back full circuit. So now when you're in the lungs, we are going to repeat external respiration, and this time we unload our CO2, we breathe it out, and this time we load in
oxygen.
Good. So we've kind of come full circle with that whole gas exchange and respiration process. So basically, the whole process of breathing involves four steps. Breathing in and out allows for us to load and unload gases. We take them for a ride, and we load and unload gases once again in our body's systemic capillaries. So that's how we accomplish the process of total gas exchange. All right, so how about questions so far? Feel pretty comfortable so far? Okay. Let me take you on over to page 73 at the very top. We're going to talk about pulmonary ventilation. And I'm going to hit the lights for this too. Okay, so we're going to talk about a little bit of physics before we get into talking about how the lungs work. And the physics that we're discussing is called Boyle's Law. And this particular law is based on two variables or factors. One is pressure and the other one is volume. So we're going to abbreviate pressure as P and we'll use V for volume. Okay, so what we want to appreciate about Boyle's Law is that when one variable goes up, the other variable goes down. So if pressure increases, volume will decrease. Okay, and so we call this an inversely proportional relationship. What this means is when one variable goes up, the other variable goes down. So one way to keep it straight is just to know that these are opposite in terms of the way they work. If pressure increases, volume decreases, and vice versa. Good. Anybody else need to sign in? Thanks. Okay, so we're going to hang on to that thought. We'll come back to that in just a few minutes. Let me also introduce to you three pressures that are going to kind of involve themselves in our conversation. Keep in mind our goal here is to understand how we breathe. And one of the pressures that plays a role is atmospheric pressure. Atmospheric pressure is the pressure of the air outside your body, and it pushes on your body. Okay, and at sea level, which we're almost at sea level, atmospheric pressure is considered to be 760 millimeters mercury. Okay, so at sea level, atmospheric pressure is 760 millimeters mercury. Okay, so atmospheric pressure is the pressure of the air outside your body. It has a force, it pushes against your body. Okay, so there's another pressure. It's the pressure of the air inside your lungs, and because it is inside, let's call it intrapulmonary pressure. I'll give you a value for that one in just a minute. Now there's a third pressure that's between our two pleura. So where are the pleura located? Good. Outside or inside?
Outside.
Outside. So I'm just going to use a dotted line here so that we can exaggerate and see that form. Now we know there's serous fluid between those two layers, and that serous fluid actually creates its own pressure. Since we're sitting between the visceral and parietal pleura, let's call this pressure the intrapleural pressure. So I think we've got the stage set to now talk about how we inhale air into our lungs. You might recall there's two major sets of muscles involved in breathing in. That one would be the diaphragm sitting dome-shaped beneath our lungs. So the diaphragm, when it's in a resting position, actually sits kind of up like a dome. Now, in order to breathe in, a message comes from a respiratory center in your brain, travels through phrenic nerves in your neck, and tells your diaphragm to contract. When it contracts, it actually pushes down toward your stomach. So it's going to flatten out when it's time for you to inhale, and that allows for an increase in volume in your thoracic cavity. Okay, so the diaphragm is going to kind of act like a pump. It flattens down, and that allows for an increase in volume in your thoracic cavity. The other set of muscles we're going to notice are those intercostal muscles. Where are they situated?
Between the ribs.
Good. And if you put your hands on your rib cage and take a breath of air, notice what happens to your rib cage. It expands out. Good. So in order to get air into your lungs, your rib cage actually has to flare out so that you can pull air in. So the rib cage is then, I'm just going to exaggerate this, get bigger. Okay. All right, so in order to breathe in, the very first thing that has to happen is these muscles must contract. Your diaphragm contracts, it pushes down in a flattened position, and your intercostal muscles contract, causing your rib cage to flare out. So these muscles cause an increase in volume, and a decrease in what?
Pressure.
Decrease in pressure. And the specific pressure that we're going to talk about here is this one, intrapulmonary pressure. All right, so thinking back to Bio-210, you probably learned about diffusion, right? And one of the things we always say is particles during diffusion move from high concentration to
low concentration.
Got it, good. Same concept applies here, except we're working with pressures. The airflow in your lungs goes from high pressure to
low pressure.
You got it. So in order to pull air into your lungs from outside your body, that intrapulmonary pressure must be the low pressure. So it's got to be lower than 760. Let's use 756. It's going to be somewhere in that neighborhood, 754, 755, 756. The catch is, though, we are less than atmospheric pressure. Okay, so that allows us to flow from high to low. So let's hit that story from the top. In order to breathe in, a message is initiated by your brain. You actually have a pacemaker in your brain that says, time for you to breathe. When that pacemaker turns on a message, it sends it down through your neck, through phrenic nerves. That message arrives at your external intercostal muscles and your diaphragm, telling both sides of your body to contract. When the diaphragm contracts, it pushes down flat. And when your intercostal muscles contract, they flare out your rib cage. Now, since we've made a bigger space for your lungs, we say the volume in your thoracic cavity has increased. In turn, what happens to your intrapulmonary pressure?
Decreases.
Why does air flow in?
Because of the concentration gradient.
Yeah, you've got a pressure gradient, right? You've got a lower pressure inside, a higher pressure outside your body, and so air follows the pressure gradient. From 760 outside, to 756 in your lungs. And so that's why we breathe in. You don't normally hear yourself suck air in like a vacuum cleaner, but in fact, that's what we're doing. We're sucking air in. And if someone were to have a respiratory disorder, you would hear a wheezing noise as that person inhaled. So normally it's a sound, a noiseless process. We haven't talked about this much yet. Let's talk about intrapleural pressure. That is the pressure that's situated between your visceral and your parietal layers on the outside of your lungs. What keeps those two layers stuck together?
Serous
fluid, good. You ever sit a glass on a table full of ice water, come back 30 minutes or an hour later, what's happened to your glass?
Stuck
to the table, it's sweated, right? Mm-hmm. And if you pick your glass straight up off the table, you're gonna have to break the suction, right? But if you cant your glass over sideways, you'll break the suction and then you can lift your glass straight up. That is what we call cohesion. And that means that water molecules like to stick together. So if we just expanded your rib cage and your parietal pleura went out, guess what your visceral pleura has no choice but to do? Go out too. So because those layers are stuck together, the visceral goes where the parietal goes. And that's one of the reasons we see an increase in volume in your thoracic cavity. Now that is the intrapleural pressure between those two layers. It should always be less than, or we say negative to, your intrapulmonary pressure. The reason it has to be less than is if it ever becomes equal to your intrapulmonary pressure, what happens to your lungs? They collapse, right. So gotta have a negative intrapleural pressure. I'm gonna make it around 748. And I'm just going to make a note that this one must be negative or less than. Okay, must be negative or less than our intrapulmonary pressure. So let's hit this one from the top. When you breathe, there's a message coming from a respiratory center in your brain. That message travels down your phrenic nerves in your neck. Those phrenic nerves innervate your external intercostals and what other breathing muscle?
Diaphragm.
Good. I'm sure you probably heard somebody say, breathe from the diaphragm, right? Okay, so that gives you a good deep breath of air. When your diaphragm contracts, what happens to its shape?
It flattens.
It flattens, good. And when your intercostal muscles contract, what happens to your rib cage?
Expands
and flares out. By doing both of these muscle contractions, what are we doing to the volume in your thoracic cavity?
Increasing it.
And we know that this is an inversely proportional relationship, so intrapulmonary pressure must decrease, right? So in order to get the air to flow in, we must have a pressure in the lungs that is lower than atmospheric pressure. So at 756 millimeters mercury, we are less than 760 in atmospheric pressure. So what happens to airflow? Comes in, right. This is inhalation. And of course, as long as your intrapleural pressure, the pressure between those two pleura, is negative to or less than our intrapulmonary pressure, our lungs stay inflated. So that's why when you saw the pictures of pneumothorax and all those air pockets in the lungs, those lungs collapse because this pressure now becomes greater than intrapulmonary pressure. So it squeezes it, it collapses. You so far so good?
Yeah.
Okay, so I ended up turning this one into inhalation. We'll head down here and do exhalation.
so in order to exhale air, all we need to do is let our muscles relax. That is, if you have a healthy respiratory system. So when you stop telling the diaphragm and intercostals to contract, they return back to their relaxed state. That means that your rib cage is going to relax back to a more narrow position. And what happens to that flattened diaphragm? Goes back up. Yep, so it comes back up into a dome-shaped position. All right, so that's one of the first things we need to see in order to cause exhalation or expiration to occur. We need to see the muscles, around that rib cage to relax, diaphragm relaxes. Okay, so if you end up decreasing the size of space for your lungs, we say that the volume now has done what?
Decreased.
Volume has now decreased. And of course, we know that pressure is inversely proportional, so it will
increase.
Good. Okay, and the very specific pressure we're talking about that needs to increase is?
Intrapulmonary.
Good. Atmospheric pressure is 760 millimeters mercury. In order for you to exhale, your intrapulmonary pressure must be
greater
than that. Yeah, so you could say something like 762. And that's basically it. In order for you to exhale, let your muscles relax. Decrease the volume of your thoracic cavity, increase your intrapulmonary pressure, and you're going to force the air to come back out. Okay, and just to draw back in our story of that intrapleural pressure, as long as that intrapleural pressure is less than or negative to intrapulmonary pressure, what happens to your lungs?
They stay
inflated. Yep, so as long as that intrapulmonary pressure is less than or negative to your intrapulmonary pressure, your lungs stay inflated. So inhalation and inspiration involve air movement in. This is exhalation, also known as expiration. That involves air movement back out.
That's a positive 758 for that intrapleural.
It is a positive, yeah.
So it has to be less than the intrapulmonary.
Got to be less than intrapulmonary, yeah. And they say negative too, but I think it's just a confusing way to say it has to be less than that intrapulmonary pressure.
So this one on this side, but intrapulmonary pressure, is it negative? Did you put that negative?
There's not a negative sign there. It's,
okay.
Yeah, it's positive.
Less than the intrapulmonary.
Just less.
That's
okay.
It.
Okay.
Just less than, because
okay.
I think it's confusing to say negative too.
Yeah,
but
okay.
It's
okay.
Just
negative
less
number.
Than. Yeah, it
okay.
Makes you think negative number, but it's
yeah.
Not.
Right.
Yeah. So if you were trying to figure out how a patient's going to breathe, whether they're going to breathe in or out, well, if you know the atmospheric pressure, and we can just assume it's 760, if the intrapulmonary pressure is more than atmospheric pressure, you're going to exhale. Or if it's a lower intrapulmonary pressure, you're going to inhale. Yep. So we can just know that it flows from high to low, and that's going to drive that air movement in and out. This is a cool little easy contraption to make. This is basically, they call it a bell jar contraption. It's got something akin to a drinking straw on top and balloons. I mean, this is dead easy to make. And it's got what you would essentially use as a rubber glove here on the very bottom. And you'll notice those lungs are deflated right now, so they're kind of like at the stage of exhalation. What should I do to the diaphragm on the bottom to cause them to inhale? Let's see if I can, there we go. Yep, so if you just pull down, you can get those lungs to inflate.
Oh, wow.
So, how cool, how simple, right?
Cool.
And then if you let go and if you push up, you'll notice those balloons really deflate. So, real simple concept just to kind of drive the whole point home. Yeah. So you could play with that for hours, right? Okay. Let's see, a couple of terms at the bottom of your page, I want to make sure we cover those. Okay, so at the very bottom, airway resistance, like peripheral resistance for blood flow, is anything that impedes the flow of air into your lungs. So if you have, say, you know, obstructions, perhaps some kind of mucus, maybe some kind of inflammation, those kinds of things can actually reduce the airflow. The surface tension in your lungs is an issue because we have a lot of moisture in our lungs. That moisture is there really because of the number of capillaries surrounding all those alveolar air sacs. It's easy for moisture to get into those air spaces. The problem with having moisture there is moisture loves to cling together. The issue of cohesiveness comes back to play again. If you have moist air sacs clinging together, guess what happens to your lung tissue? Collapse, right. So in order to prevent lung collapse, we line our lungs with an oily secretion. What do we call it? Surfactant. Good, so yeah, that oily surfactant reduces the surface tension. And then finally, the elasticity of our lungs is very important. It's our ability to recoil back to our original position after we've exhaled or as we're exhaling in order to push that air out of our lungs. If you have lost elasticity, then you have lost lung compliance. And now you have to work to get the air out of your lungs. What disorder does this sound like?
Asthma.
Could be asthma.
COPD.
COPD, yep, so that covers them all. So if you lose lung compliance or elasticity, that can lead to COPD. We just have a couple minutes left. I'd like to take you just to the top of page 74 for just a moment. I've actually talked you through this. I didn't tell you. So there is a respiratory center, just like there is a cardiovascular center. These centers are housed in the medulla oblongata, and you'll also notice in this picture, some of our respiratory control is housed in the nearby pons. So, you know, here again, we're looking at that medulla to be a control center for breathing, just like it was for heart rate and for vessel diameter. There is a pacemaker that sits in this neighborhood up here that actually turns on breathing about every 5 seconds for an adult. So that respiratory center pacemaker sends a message by way of the phrenic nerves. They travel in your neck. Those phrenic nerves innervate your external intercostal muscles and what other dome-shaped muscle?
Diaphragm,
good. Every time a nerve impulse is sent along that pathway, your diaphragm and intercostal should contract, okay? So let me get you the blanks here in your worksheet. The phrenic nerve is the first blank. If you need the spelling, it's P-H-R-E-N-I-C.
That's basically the pacemaker for the lungs?
Yeah, the brain's respiratory center has the pacemaker.
What's that called?
It's actually in the medulla and pons.
Oh, okay.
We don't have to worry about it in the show.
Okay. No, I don't.
Okay.
We don't want anything else.
Just keep it simple, right?
Uh-huh. So you just, it's in the medulla.
It's in the medulla.
And it's a pacemaker that allows you to say you can breathe.
Yeah, okay, exactly. Okay, so phrenic nerve, and it says, as a result of contraction, the thorax volume will do what?
Increase.
Yeah, increase in pressure will
decrease.
Good. So volume increases and pressure decreases. You know, in the summertime, we often hear about someone who has gone swimming into a pool. Maybe they dive into the pool, they break their neck. And unfortunately, if you break the phrenic nerve connections in your neck, there is no way to tell your diaphragm and intercostal muscles to breathe. So that is really unfortunate that breaking one's neck actually can interrupt that communication process. Even if you break one side and not the other, that side of the body is no longer able to contract and do the breathing process. So the other side may be able to, but you know, we've got to have both sides to be able to pull that air in. That inhalation process takes about 3 seconds in a resting adult, and then after that time period, that respiratory center pacemaker shuts off. And at that point, your diaphragm and intercostal muscles return back to a relaxed state, and for the next 2 seconds or so, you're going to exhale. So it's interesting that a normal resting respiration rate takes around 5 seconds for you to breathe in and out. And if you do the math, every 5 seconds to breathe in and out is around 12 breaths per minute. So on your worksheet, you'll notice a term there called eupnea. Starts with an E, oddly enough. And they say that the normal resting breathing rate is around 12 to 15 breaths per minute. I should tell you that, and I've had nursing students in here before, they're telling nursing it's 12 to 18, so I'll take anything within that range of 12 to 18, okay? So that's for a resting adult. Kids, of course, have a faster respiratory rate than adults. And just want to mention the last bullet point there, expiratory neurons normally don't turn on unless you're forcefully exhaling. If you've climbed the stairs in this building, you've had the experience of your expiratory neurons. You know how you can't help but breathe heavy as you come up those steps?
I don't know. People think I'm that out of shape.
Breathe quietly.
And don't talk to me because I can't breathe, right? So when you feel those expiratory neurons working, that's when you're having to force that air out. All right, we'll pick up there on Tuesday. Y'all have a great weekend.